Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Honorable Supreme Court of the State of Nebraska is now open for the transaction of business. Draw nigh, all ye having business with this honorable court, and ye shall be heard. God save the state of Nebraska and this honorable court.
Thank you very much, and I would normally say you may be seated, but hopefully you are already all seated. This is a first for the Nebraska Supreme Court. Last month, we did teleconferencing for oral arguments, but we wanted to have a visual side to this process. We are being webcast by NET, so this is open to all of the world to see, including all of you on WebEx. So we appreciate your patience, and we greet you this morning. I believe all the members of the court are on board, and I think we've got all of this morning's lawyers who are going to argue signed up and ready to go. We're going to try and conduct this the way we do oral arguments normally, so attorneys will be will give their presentations, and anytime a judge wants to ask a question, the judge will ask a question. There's also a feature where they can signal virtually that they want to ask a question. But I think that I think judges will be, pardon the expression, interrupting you to ask questions. And so we will, as I said, try to proceed like normal. And we will go from one case to the next. There will be no lengthy break between cases. So with that in mind, the first case of the day is LaSalle versus State of Nebraska. Justice Castle is recused from this matter. Both sides have 15 minutes to argue, and it appears to me, Ms. Neary, I will direct this question to you. Are you going to split your time with Mr. Barton?
We are, with the court's permission, Your Honor.
You certainly have that permission. How much time is each party going to take?
Your Honor, we would like to reserve 4 minutes for rebuttal, and I will be arguing on the summary judgment issue, and I'd like 7 minutes, and Mr. Barton would have four, and then four for rebuttal, Your Honor.
Thank you very much. Madam Bailiff, do you have that?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, we'll try and keep track of that. And before we proceed with arguments, do any of the lawyers who are arguing today have any questions about the process?
No, Your Honor.
Thank you very much. I greatly appreciate that. Don't hesitate to ask questions if you do have questions. And with that, we will begin LaSalle versus State of Nebraska. Ms. Neary, good morning to you, and you may proceed.
Good morning, Your Honor. Good morning, members of the court. My name is Kathleen Neary, and I will be addressing the trial court's erroneous grant of summary judgment in favor on the state, in favor of the state on the wage and hour claim. And my co-counsel, Joe Barton, will be addressing the denials of class certification. What is this case not about? This is not about a breach of the union contract. What is this case not about? It is not about a violation of the Fair Labor Standards Act or denial of overtime pay. Those are non-issues. This case is about a violation of the Nebraska Wage Payment and Collection Act. This case is about a scheme devised by the state of Nebraska in 2016 to deprive Ryan LaSalle, who is an hourly rate employee of the Lincoln Regional Center, of wages that are due and owing to him for earned and approved paid time off that he took. The state's scheme prohibited LaSalle from receiving pay and wages when his paid time off that he took, when combined with the actual hours he worked at LRC, exceeded 40 hours in a week. For example, if LaSalle physically worked at the Regional Center 32 hours Monday through Thursday, and then he took 8 hours of approved vacation leave on Friday, and then he was called in and required, mandated to work an additional 8 hours on Saturday, the state refused to pay him for the 8 hours of vacation leave that he took on Friday. And mind you,
did the state return the vacation time then?
Well, Your Honor, yes, the state returned the vacation time to a leave bank. But Your Honor, that's a red herring argument in appellant's opinion. Why? Because banked leave time is not negotiable currency. Brian LaSalle cannot go out and pay his mortgage, buy groceries, put gas in his car with banked leave time. Also, that deals with just the vacation time. But with regard to the sick time, that's a really big problem in this case. Because when Brian LaSalle, who's worked at the Lincoln Regional Center for 27 years and has accrued by statute, Chapter 81 of Nebraska statutes, when he leaves the state of Nebraska's employment, he will be paid some of his sick leave, but only 25% of it. Meaning, if he had 480 hours of banked sick leave when he leaves, he's not going to be paid $18.75 per hour, which is his rate, when he leaves employment. He is going to receive 25 cents on the dollar for that leave. Also, they didn't return all of the leave because bereavement leave is use it or lose it. Brian LaSalle's brother passed away after the 2016 scheme was put into effect. He requested and was approved for 8 hours of bereavement leave. And once his combined work hours and paid time off exceeded 40, he was denied pay for those hours of bereavement leave. They aren't banked. They aren't granted. And what's important about this case, when we talk about 8 hours of this or 8 hours of that, this is real money. Every time they denied LaSalle his statutory right to be paid for approved PTO that he took, it cost him around $150 in a paycheck each time that they deleted, physically deleted time from his time card.
Ms. Neary?
Yes.
You led your argument by saying this is not a case about a breach of the union contract, but I want to ask you a question about that. Does the right to the leave time arise out of the union contract? I understand it's structured as a wage payment and collection act violation, but are you contending that the right to the leave time arises from some source other than the union contract?
Yes, Your Honor. Nebraska.
What is that? I'm sorry. Where was the agreement then? If it's not in the union contract, where was the agreement to pay leave time in this manner?
Nebraska Revised Statute Section 81-1320 and 1328 mandate that LaSalle shall accrue paid time off according to his years of service with the state. And I said before, he's been employed by the state for 27 years.
And so you're contending that there was an agreement reached by the state and by Mr. LaSalle through that statutory provision?
Well, I think it's only reasonable to assume that if he has a statutory right to accumulate leave based on that statutory provision, in those sections, that he would be able to use that leave. And Your Honor, that's not even an issue in this case, because each instance that we're talking about, the thousands of dollars that Joe LaSalle was denied in pay, that it was approved leave. And what is really egregious about this case is once LaSalle would exceed 40 hours of combined paid time off and work time, the payroll employees of the state would go in and physically delete from his time card his pay.
Is Mr. LaSalle an overtime eligible employee?
He is, but this case has nothing to do with overtime.
I understand that's your position, but when you're contending the leave time plus the hours worked exceeded 40 hours, are you contending that he was should have received overtime pay to the extent those combined numbers went over 40 hours?
Your Honor, under the Fair Labor Standards Act, paid time off, like vacation, sick, or bereavement leave, does not go into the calculation of overtime pay per statute.
So your contention is
that, oh, pardon me.
No, go ahead.
Do you mind, Justice Savage?
No, go ahead, please do.
Counsel, do you believe that, say, with respect to the bereavement, use it or lose it, that's antithetical to the statute?
Yes, Your Honor. I mean, it's he has a right as a 27-year employee of the state to take 5 days of bereavement leave per year. If he is not paid for that, when he takes it, he loses it, and it will not be banked.
And I'm trying to understand the breadth of what you think the statute encompasses.
Your Honor, Your Honor? Oh,
yes.
Sorry. I just blanked out there. And maybe the court did that. Your Honor, what we do know is that he has a legal entitlement to the bereavement leave.
All right. Thank you.
Yes. Your Honor, I think I've exceeded 7 minutes, and I would like to then defer to Mr. Barton, please.
Thank you very much, Mr. Barton. Good morning to you.
Good morning, and please the court. I'm going to address the class certification denial, and there's really two main components under Nebraska law to certify a class. And the first is whether or not there's questions of common or general interest, and second, whether or not there's numerous parties. It's only the first question that is if it was contested in this case. And then there are two subsidiary factors that to be addressed with respect to the common issues portion. And that is whether or not there are common issues that predominate and whether or not there are any adverse interests among members of the class. And the common interest focuses on whether or not there's uniform or varying proof. In this case, the central issue concerns whether defendants' adoption and implementation of a changed or new policy violated Nebraska law. The defendants admit that that policy, this new policy, applied to all DHH staff who are full-time, non-exempt employees. A challenge to employment policy or practices establishes common questions. That was clear in the Poynings case, in the Gantt case, from the analogous federal law under Rule 23, that's also the case. The defendants cite the United States Supreme Court decision from Walmart versus Dukes to suggest that there is an issue here with varying proof, but they misunderstand that case. The central problem and the problem that led the Supreme Court to reverse certification in that case was that there was no central policy. By admission by the plaintiffs, the issue was that there was no central policy, and the plaintiffs in that case was challenging the lack of a central policy. That's not a problem here. There is a central policy, and that's what's being challenged.
What was the basis for the district court's denial of class certification?
The district court here, with respect to uniform proof, concluded that there would be varying proof for determining whether individual class members had a right to recover money. But what that ignores is several fundamental principles. First of all, the amount of recovery among class members can vary. That's number one. Second, the complaint sought declaratory and injunctive relief against this policy. This policy is ongoing. And what this really focuses on is whether or not a particular class member, a particular person, is entitled to a monetary payment under the policy. But because the policy focuses or is applied to all of the staff, there is an interest of all the members in terms of determining the legality of the policy itself. And the issue here—
To determine the extent to which the individual class members were denied compensation, are each of them going to have to come in with their own time cards and prove up hours that they were denied? And it was the district court concerned about that?
I think that was the district court's concern. However, that's a misplaced concern. The issue here, and I think the dispute between the plaintiff and the defendant, is not whether or not records exist. It is what are the source of the records and whether or not there's a database. We believe that there's sufficient evidence, at least to meet our burden down below, that there was a database. But even if there was no database that tracked all of this, even if there's no database systems, records in and of itself, even if they're paper records, even if they required voluminous materials to go through, establishes a method of identifying class members and a method of paying them.
Is that the right order of business to consider the difficulty of proof as compared to the commonality of the claims? In other words, is this a typical plaintiff, or will there be other folks who don't have issues with vacation, but they do have issues with sick leave and so forth? Does that matter?
From our purposes of commonality, no. Commonality exists of whether or not these particular policies are legal or illegal under Nebraska law. The issue in determining who gets paid is really a question of either a question of assigning damages or determining whether or not someone's going to get paid, a question of administration. And the worst that happens if there are missing records for some people, if the state doesn't have all the records, is that some people wouldn't get paid. That's the worst that happens. But to the extent there are records, they would get paid. We would seek a determination for injunctive and declaratory relief for all members who are affected by this policy. And the debate in the federal courts in terms of what is necessary is really a question of, to just Judge Papik's question, or Justice Papik's question is, can a class member come in with its own method of proof versus does there have to be some sort of set of records that the defendant has, or can it be based on a class member coming in? The Ninth Circuit, the Seventh Circuit, clearly in the Ninth Circuit and the federal courts would say even class member declarations is sufficient. The more conservative or more limited version is the Third Circuit, who says if there are records, it doesn't have to be some uniform system, but if there are records, that will suffice. There just has to be a way to identify these class members. Moving on to whether or not the second point that the district court reason for denying class was the determination of an intra-class conflict. And what this issue really focuses on, and what this court has focused on, is there economic injury? An economic injury to a member of the class. Will some member of the class, some person who is included in the class, be harmed if the lawsuit succeeds economically? And that's what this court has focused on. It's what the federal court's focused on. Will some member of the class be economically injured if this lawsuit succeeds? There has to be a loss to that person. That's what this court has focused on. It's what the court focused on in Hornings. And if you look even to the defendant's cases, that's what those cases focus on. They focus on some sort of out-of-pocket economic injury to a member of the class. The other thing that this court has said is that there needs to be evidence. And if you look at defendant's brief itself, they're talking about may, could happen, might have happened. There was no evidence. Compared to, and I think what plaintiff put through in terms of uniformity of people complaining, and what you think about this and what Ms. Neary explained is, even at the defendant's best case, this is a question of when people get paid, is this lawsuit does not hurt anybody if we succeed.
I believe that is your allotted time, Mr. Barton. So thank you very much. We will go on to the appellee, Ms. Caldwell. Good morning to you.
Good morning, Your Honor, and members of the court. May it please the court, Stephanie Caldwell, Assistant Attorney General and counsel for the appellees, HHS, and the state of Nebraska. The issues on this appeal are straightforward. The state asserts there's no language controlling under the binding collective bargaining agreement for the wages LaSalle alleges he is owed and due under the Collection Act. LaSalle argues, however, because it's not forbidden, it's permitted. However, this is not the analysis for these types of wage cases, and the authority is not what cannot be made or what is limited, but instead a requisite showing is required that it must be made based on what the parties previously agreed to. And here's where the district court found LaSalle did not meet his burden for a claim under the Wage Payment Collection Act. His claim had no merit, and necessarily he could not represent a case where his class where his case was warrantless, or where his pled class could not be maintained within the jurisdictional limits or judicial capacity of the court. So LaSalle claims he's owed a wage in the form of a leave paid by his employer, HHS, in addition to a fully worked pay period. The operative complaint that LaSalle has filed in this case has numerous citations to the applicable and controlling labor union contract as LaSalle's authority to his entitlement for the wage. The district court then, in its analysis, properly turned to the contract to determine if the employer agreed to pay what LaSalle wages under these circumstances.
The court seemed to indicate that Mr. LaSalle's claim actually arises from a statutory source. What is your response to that?
The statute that the appellant has cited to is the Nebraska statute with regards to when an employee accrues scheduling time, its schedule. That's contrary to what's pled in the operative complaint, and it's contrary to what this court's precedent has been. The court has looked to what has been agreed to by the parties, and LaSalle's operative complaint, what he has pled, is the labor union contract controls. That language is found specifically within the collective bargaining agreement. It's what LaSalle has pled, and it's what this court has looked to and examined for these types of cases to see what did the parties previously agree to. Even if LaSalle is using the statute that was cited by Ms. Neary in oral argument, there is still no agreed to language in that situation that the employer, HHS, would pay leave payments in addition to a fully worked week.
If the state, taking the hypothetical Ms. Neary offered, where the employee has worked 32 hours and then they wish to take 8 hours of leave time, and then they're asked to come in on a Saturday and work 8 more hours. If the state were to do that time and time again, requiring the employee to work 40 hours, and they were never able to use their leave, does the employee have a remedy? And if so, what is the remedy for that?
I'm going to answer that question in two parts, Your Honor. First, the hypothetical fails and is not supported by the record. The hypothetical that an employee were to work 4 days, take vacation, and then get called in on a Saturday is not permitted under the labor union contract. The only time an employee can be mandatorily overtimed is if the employee is already on campus, already on facility, and is asked to stay hours beyond that. So, and there's no record or evidence in this record that any of those instances applied to LaSalle. This was also testified to by the timekeeper at the regional center that the way these types of scenarios happen and what happened in Mr. LaSalle's case is the employee later comes in and works a free day or their day off to do that. The simple solution that the timekeeper said, what she told employees was, do not come in and work your free day. The second part to your question, Your Honor, is there still a remedy? With regards to the labor contract, it says leave shall not be unreasonably denied or deferred, and it's not. There's no example in this case that LaSalle has ever had to forfeit or lose any leave time. But also under your hypothetical, say that were to happen, there are still procedures in place within the labor contract under Section 12 that say, I believe it's 14.7, that's Exhibit 41 of the labor contract before the court, saying if an employee is unable to use that time under that scenario, they still have a right to request it at the end of the year and receive a cash payment for that leave.
I'd like to kind of zoom back a little bit. Is the position of the state driven by, or what is the significance of the fact that DHS says, it, as an agency, is assigned just a certain number of FTEs? How relevant is that fact in constructing the application of this relationship?
To answer that question, that's true. That's how all state agencies work. They're assigned a number of FTEs, which is a full-time equivalent. That's part of the budgeting process. And it's also intertwined within the terms of the labor contract as to what the employee and the employer agreed to a work schedule. So as part of that process, employees, the state has a duty to pay employees their full-time equivalent. That's what they, based on the budgeting process, and even within the labor contract, they've agreed to pay for the work period. The only reference to paying above and beyond that work period is contained within the overtime provisions, which complies with wage and hour laws. If an employee works beyond those, then they are entitled to payment for hours actually worked in those instances.
But that is essentially the framework for budgeting, isn't it? Or am I wrong?
Absolutely. That is absolutely how the state works. HHS is allotted X number of FTEs, and that's essentially how they became aware of what was happening, in that employees were being overpaid. The state auditor audited the agency and found they were being overpaid. The agency has a duty and a requirement to ensure that employees are paid for their hours work, but also a duty to make sure they are not overpaid. And here the state auditor found they were overpaying their employees, contrary to the previously agreed to language of the labor union contract.
Well, that's what auditors do, right?
Well, and I think that's an important step in this process, especially when we're looking at payment, whether or not it was properly issued or not. But yes, I would agree, Your Honor.
Thank you.
So just to follow up, I would say that the court then, within its discretion, properly looked at the terms of the contract. While LaSalle alleges that the contract may be of some guidance to this court, or the state's reliance on it is an alleged red herring, it is instead the obligatory site to look to see what did the parties agree to. It is what this court has done in all cases under wage payment collection cases where the understanding of the parties is set forth in a memorialized or written agreement. And especially this is what LaSalle has pled in his operative complaint. There are numerous citations to the labor contract. And the answer is there is no mandatory language when LaSalle has absolutely been asked several times what entitles him to this payment, what was previously agreed to. He cannot answer that because the question is, and the answer is, there's no language within the contract. As a matter of law, the district court properly denied that.
And we here,
go ahead.
No, go ahead, Justice Papik.
Do we need to look at anything other than the labor contract to decide this? I mean, it seems to me that both sides point to some evidence in the summary judgment record of this is how this person understood this contract. Do we need to look at that, or is this just a matter of looking at the language of the contract and deciding if it's unambiguous as a matter of law?
I would agree that in this court's de novo review for a contract interpretation, it only needs to look at the four corners of the contract. That constitutes the binding and final agreement and is set forth in the intent and merger clauses. While both sides did cite to some extrinsic evidence, the purpose of doing so was in the event of another propounded argument that the court would found ambiguity. But this court has held absent latent ambiguity, there is no need to look beyond the labor contract. And in the instances where the court has examined extrinsic evidence has been where there's been no labor contract. And the cases cited by LaSalle to this court arguing that it should, or that the issue is a question of fact, are simply false and misleading. These involved cases where there was no written, no memorialized collective bargaining agreement. And to hold that we should disregard, or this court should disregard, the collective bargaining agreement is an extraordinary decision. It would significantly impact and negate the lengthy and complex negotiating process, contradict the express terms of the contract, including the merger and intent clauses, create tenuous liability, contrary to contract principles, and potentially inundate the court system with contract disputes. Short answer to that is yes. You may look at the four corners of the contract. Is there any language showing what the parties previously agreed to or to pay LaSalle in these instances? The answer is no. Therefore, LaSalle's claim fails as a matter of law.
So we're here on summary judgment, and you are telling us, I believe, that There are no material issues of fact, and in reality, this is a question of law interpreting the contract. Is that right?
Absolutely, Your Honor, and I believe that's what the district court properly found. As much as LaSalle has attempted to prove there are issues of fact, we've repeatedly cited in our brief, there are no issues of fact. LaSalle claims he's owed a wage. He cites to the labor contract. We do not dispute that the labor contract says what it says. To determine if the labor contract entitled LaSalle to a wage and to determine what the parties previously agreed to, the binding and controlling evidence is the labor contract. While the bill of exceptions in this case is exceptionally large, it involves several exhibits and records not even involved on this appeal. The summary judgment record was actually fairly short and is contained within two volumes of volume 4 and 5. And this court, as a matter of law, can make that exact determination, and is what this court has done in wage and hour cases, has determined as a matter of law, and in some instances on summary judgment, the entitlement to a wage based on looking at what the parties agreed to.
Thank you. And then turning your attention to the class certification issue, what is the status of that as far as we are concerned? What is our standard of review there?
I think that's a significant point to start with, is that this court has held that the standard of review for class certifications on appeal is considerable discretion, abuse of discretion. But this court has repeatedly said considerable discretion is vested with the trial court. And in this case, Judge Colburn did not abuse his discretion and alternatively gave LaSalle numerous opportunities to prove a class. The court examined all the evidence propounded by both parties, issued logical, extensive, well-reasoned opinions, not once but twice denying class certification and explaining why in its judgment and in its discretion it would defeat judicial economy to certify a case in this class. The court examined all the evidence and found of great concern the presence of varying proofs similar to other cases cited in our briefs under Nebraska applicable case law that would essentially require the district court to conduct extensive individualized analysis or mini trials for each of the 1,400 proposed class members. And Judge Colburn in the district court made it clear that he was not making this determination based on what the damages would be, but whether or not the liability, whether or not the determination as to whether or not an employee would be owed a wage. And Justice Pavick, you had asked whether or not this would involve reviewing each employee's time card and their approval method. It absolutely would. And this was the evidence offered by the state and that Judge Colburn relied upon, saying it just would be impossible to entertain a class action under these circumstances. The district court also found several conflicts of interest, and while LaSalle attempts to say that we made arguments that it may be this or their conflicts may arise, this is absolutely the standard this court has said in the Blankenship case that we have cited, that even potentially existing conflicts are enough to deny class certification. The state offered evidence showing the potentiality of these conflicts. The district court properly took these into consideration and did find that some members would stand to be adversely affected. Some may not share the same outcome that LaSalle may wish. And because of this, class certification remained improper. And so I think there's just simply no evidence of any abuse of discretion in this case. The court reviewed the evidence, considered it twice, considered a renewed motion, even though it was filed beyond the court's progression order deadline to file class certifications, and any allegations of new evidence or a new code that would somehow show these new class members, one, the district court found that was false and misleading by LaSalle based on the evidence LaSalle himself submitted, that there was no, in fact, this code that could be done, and it was also proven by affidavits and evidence offered by the state to do that. And again, the court found that this information was readily available to LaSalle early on in the litigation, and it still, most importantly, did not defeat the court's finding that this would require an individualized analysis, mini trials, as to each member's entitlement to a claim. Based on these reasons, the district court properly decided as a matter of law, LaSalle failed to make a claim under the Wage Payment and Collection Act, and second, that class certification remained impossible and would defeat the interest of judicial economy in this case. For these reasons, we ask that the court uphold the decision of the district court.
Thank you very much. Do we have any time for rebuttal?
No, Your Honor.
There is no time for rebuttal. So I want to thank all the parties for participating in this historic moment in the history of the Nebraska Supreme Court. And I'm going to declare it as a victory for all of us. I think everyone, I think all of the justices and all of the lawyers arguing, this all worked very well. So